This is an interview with Irvin Luton in the Jefferson Room at the Oregon Historical Society. The date is March 16th, 1988, and the interviewer is Jim Strassmayer for the Oregon Historical Society, and this is tape one, side one. We're doing a kind of an unusual thing today, Irv. We're starting out with in the middle of your interview, which we eventually will do, and we're getting into a part of your career, a section of your career that's really kind of in the middle of things. And so I wonder if you could start out today by just kind of briefly telling us where you are in your career, what you are doing at the time that we start to talk about Mark Hatfield.
Well, this would be, as I recall, Hatfield would have been there about the early 60s as governor. And I can't recall just when he was elected to what year he was elected as a representative. But I came to the Oregon legislature in 1953 as a lobbyist for a brief period, and then 1955, August 1953, the whole session. And I first met Hatfield whenever he was elected to the legislature, and I don't recall what date that was or what year that was that he was elected to the House.
Yes, in 51.
Well, he was there then when I first started lobbying. My impression of him was that he was regarded by the other Republicans as being on the very liberal edge of the Republican Party. But one must bear in mind that at that time, the Republicans who were in the legislature were very, very conservative. Mm-hmm. And he was regarded as a protege of Phillips, who was the kingmaker, one of the kingmakers in the Republican Party. I've forgotten what his first name was, Bill Phillips or something like that. But he was the one, as I understood it, who had a great deal of influence in having Hatfield enter a career in politics. And he got a lot of support for Hatfield when Hatfield ran not only for the House, but when he ran for the Senate, when he ran as governor. And there was some feeling among some of the Republicans at that time that Phillips was too liberal. and there was some concern that Hatfield would not be a good influence in the Republican Party at that time, but that later was to change a great deal. I found him to be he was a little aloof, and it wasn't an aloofness that I would say was something that was indigenous in his personality, but more that he felt that he had to be a little aloof as a legislator to shield himself, that was my interpretation of it, shield himself from the various pressures that lobbyists and others and different interest groups placed on him. This was most noticeable, I think, when you came to talk to him about a bill. Whereas a lot of the Republicans would tell you, without your asking, mm-hmm. well, I'm for it or I'm against it, Hatfield was very, very careful not to commit himself and to wait until he got more information, mm-hmm. wait until he was sure that he was taking a proper position, which is something that I appreciated mm-hmm. very much. He was always friendly, courteous.
I may interrupt with just one observation about something you said earlier, why were they taking Hatfield so seriously as a possible leader this early in the, when he was in the House of Representatives in 51 and 53? Didn't he seem like a pretty junior prospect, or why was he seen as a prospect at all?
Well, I think it was because of his knowledge of politics, his academic knowledge of politics, plus the fact that he had charisma. There was no question about it. And he was extremely intelligent. He spoke well when he got up to speak on a bill. And he was an attractive person. I think that was one of the things that made a lot of people think that he was going to go somewhere. And there were people in the Republican Party who were looking for somebody young and intelligent, who would be a good candidate and who would add luster to the party. And those people like Phillips, and I think Doug McKay was one, and I've forgotten who some of the others were. They saw in Hatfield a comer, and I think anybody who watched him in operation in those days would have agreed with that without any question, because he handled himself so well in speaking on the floor, you know, in a committee room when he was on a committee. He was obviously very intelligent, and he had there was no question about his having charisma. He was an attractive person, and that I think was later demonstrated in his, when he was governor, without any question. He had appeal.
Did he seem, to some people, was there some question about his being so very youthful?
Well, there was, I suppose there was little of that, but I don't think so. If there was, it was minor. Mm-hmm. This is my opinion, anyway. There was some feeling in those days that most of the legislators were, oh, probably from 45 to 70, and they had a little concern about a very young man not having enough experience and enough political savvy, but that was minor, as far as I can see.
So you were talking about working with him and what he was like to work with. Let's see, you would be, your first contacts with him, do you recall any of those early contacts and what the situation was?
I really don't, other than there were a number of bills that I lobbied legislators on, and he was one of them. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall any specific issue in which I discussed with him. I don't recall any of that now. That's about it from the legislative standpoint.
Yeah, and so you were lobbying. You were the lobbying for Weyerhaeuser Timber Company. Weyerhaeuser Company at this time. What were the issues that you were working on that you had to bring to the legislature? Maybe both large and small.
Well, timber taxes was one, and well, corporate taxes. Things like workman's compensation, unemployment compensation, and a number of labor bills of one kind or another. There were always bills that were introduced at the behest of labor, which were too far reaching, such as requiring that an electrician that was employed by Weyerhaeuser would have to have a blue card, which means that he would have to go out and wire houses before he could wire an electric motor in an industrial plant, which didn't make any sense, even though he had been an electrician there for years. There were things like that, and these things would come up because labor was trying to prevent the industrial electrician from moonlighting and wiring houses. And so there were little things like, little bills like this that were a concern. The big ones were corporate taxation, timber taxation, workmen's comp bills, unemployment comp bills. One that I recall that we were very much interested in those early days was one that had, I had an experience with Edith Green on this one. The state had never asserted its ownership to the bottoms, to the stream beds of the state up to this point. The tidelands, not the stream bed, but the tidelands, the point between high water mark and low water mark. And then there was the state land board had a man named Alvin. And Alvin decided that the state ought to lease these lands. And even though people may have had a dock, or they may have had some other installation on the tidelands for 50 or 60 years, the state was going to assert their claim to it. And then the state would require a lease. And one of the problems that we had with it was that there was a log dump that we had down on the Millicoma River at Coos Bay, and we dumped logs over a vertical bank. And Alvin insisted that we had to lease the air between high water mark and low water mark. So Columbia River Packers Association had put in a bill, had one introduced by a legislator from Astoria, that would have permitted those who were on using these tidelands in the past to purchase them at whatever the appraised price was. The reason for that was that the Columbia River Packers plant was sitting on state tidelands between on the river. And much of Astoria was. Much of the business, many of the businesses in Astoria were. And so this bill became a very controversial bill because Governor Sprague, former Governor Sprague, and the Oregon Education Association, which was then headed by Edith Green, well, she was the lobbyist for the Oregon Education Association, saw that as a grab for state land. And there was much said about Oswald West saving the tidelands of Oregon, and this would undo that. And the Oregon Education Association was opposed to it because they saw this as an opportunity for the state to get education funds if they could lease these tidelands, because all that money would go into some educational fund. Mm-hmm. And they were very much opposed to this bill. And it was that kind of thing, that things of that sort that came up in the uh-huh. early years. Would you like to hear the rest of that story?
Yeah, sure. Now, how did they, surely there's a legislative resolution to that.
So, what happened with this bill was that it was amended to make sure that no one in the future could grab state tidelands. Mm-hmm. And And it was passed in the House, and I did some heavy lobbying on it in the House, and also in the Senate. And the Columbia Empire Industries, now Associated Learning Industries, was lobbying on it too, because there were a lot of businesses that were involved in this, that they had built things on these tide lands, and the state had never asserted any control over them or any claim for them. So Columbia Empire Industries is very much interested in this, and so Jack Lansing, who was later president of Pacific Power and Light, he was lobbying for this for Associated Oregon Industries. He and I teamed up and did the lobbying on this. Well, Joe Dyer from Astoria was the legislator who introduced this bill, and he was in the House, and he was chairman of the Fish and Game Committee. And Senator Euland from, not Port Arthur, what's the town, Coquille. Mm-hmm. Senator Euland from Coquille had introduced a bill to close the Coquille River to nets, salmon fishing, mm-hmm. nets. And Joe Dyer represented a lot of fishermen. So they met head on in this because Hewlett wanted this bill passed to close the Coquille River to nets, salmon fishing with nets, and I think there were some other rivers down there involved. And Joe Dyer, of course, was representing the fishermen too, because there was a lot of fishermen in his area. So Dyer got that bill held up in the Fish Committee in the House, so that it was bottled up there. So Euland said, "Well, I'll fix you," words to that effect. So he bottles up this tideland bill when it gets to the Senate after it passed the House. And so there we were at an impasse. That bill was bottled up in the Senate committee, and the other bill, closing the Coquille River to nets, was bottled up in that House committee. And so there was no way that they were going to compromise. Mm-hmm. So we lobbied the Senate very heavily, Jack Lansing and I, to try to get that bill out committee and get it passed. Well, former Governor Sprague had taken a position against it. He was editorializing against it. Edith Green was lobbying very heavily against it. So there was some opposition in the Senate as a result of that. But what finally happened was that the bill went right up. The bill didn't come out of committee until the last night of the session. And they were running, and the session was running way into midnight and past. And Hewlett went around spreading the word with on that bill that there was something fishy about it. It wasn't a good bill, that title of the bill. And he got one of the senators to get up and make a speech on it. Against it, and at this time some of the legislators in the Senate were pretty well along, having had too many drinks, and Hewlett was much respected in the Senate, and so he went around and said, "Gee, there's something bad about this bill," and he got this other senator. He told this other senator to stand up and oppose this bill on the basis that the poor Weyerhaeuser boys couldn't pay this fee, so all they would do was just help the Weyerhaeuser boys and big rich Weyerhaeuser, you know, use that as an argument. Well, as a result of that bill failed by one vote. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the ironic things about this was that here Edith Green had opposed it so much, and some of the other people that opposed it, like whoever was head of the land board at that time, the man who ran for governor, ran for the Senate against Hatfield, was related to the Bensons.
I don't think I can help you. I keep thinking Sig Unander.
Yeah, that's it, Sig Unander.
Okay.
He was the administrator of the state land board. He was much opposed to it. And the ironic thing about it was that after a couple of sessions, or it may have been only one session, after that bill had failed, the legislature saw the merit of just quit claiming all of this, all of these tidelands on which people had already built. So the state and the Oregon Education Association would have been much better off had they accepted the original bill, because then they would have the state would have got some money from it, because the people who were sitting on those tidelands were going to buy them at the praise price. But later on, they quit claiming the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime I'd like to tell Edith Green that.
I wanted to get back to the, some of these major issues that you were working with when you were dealing with Hatfield. Worker compensation was an issue for a number of years there. And were you aware of what Hatfield's position was in worker compensation, how he saw the problem as the legislature worked on it?
I really don't know what his feeling was about it. I think this, that Hatfield had a concern for working people, labor people, and he was more inclined than some other Republican governors were to, at least this was my observation, to give some real study and express some real concern over some of the labor bills that came in, those that were really justifiable. Whereas I think in earlier Republican governors, labor probably got a short stick. You know, there was sort of a bias against labor, and Hatfield was not biased like I think some of the other governors were in that respect.
Okay. Well, that says quite a bit. The interesting thing is that
except that he wouldn't go along with labor's excesses either, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that he had problems with the labor sometimes. I know he did,
mm-hmm.
but he had quite a bit of labor support sometimes.
Now on the this question of the tax issue, that seems to have been one of the really especially important issues that you dealt with as a lobbyist. I would like to hear how that issue developed, and you know, what your approach was to it in dealing with Hatfield government.
Well, I'm trying to remember whether that issue really blossomed at the time he was governor. I guess it did.
It was in the legislatures.
When was he governor?
He was governor from 58 through 66.
Oh,
66.
Well, yes, it did. It did develop. It developed first in about 1955 was the first time that it became a real issue, really, in the legislature. The reason for that was that the State Tax Commission, now the Department of Revenue, had historically treated timber inventories, in valuing timber inventories, treated them as a, almost as you would treat a bond, in that it was obvious that if you had owned timber in a watershed and you were a company like Weyerhaeuser or Crown Zellerbach or Willamette Industries, you were not going to cut all that timber in 1 year. The timber industry, the principal tree farming companies were trying to maintain a sustained yield. And if they were to value that all as if it were to be cut today, then the value would be extremely high because it would be at market value. All of the timber you had would be at market value. If that were true, you couldn't have maintained a sustained yield, for the simple reason that if you cut 1,000 board feet here today, but you have hundreds of thousands of board feet standing out there, the only place you get your income is from the 1,000 board feet you cut today. And if all that tax on that others based on market value were to be focused against this 1,000 board feet, you wouldn't have any profit with it. So in effect, what it would do, it would force liquidation. So the Tax Commission had for many years used a system of discounting the value of that timber. And I think, generally accepted that the timber owners of Oregon were cutting over about a 40-year period. That is, the old growth would be cut over about a 40-year period. So they had a 40% discount applied to that timber. Let's say if it was worth $40 a thousand, they discounted 40% for tax purposes, in valuing it for tax purposes. Well, there was a rather intelligent farmer, a really intelligent farmer at Goose Bay, graduate of Oregon State University, name was J.J. Gainey, G-E-A-N-E-Y, and he was a dairy farmer, but he had been a county commissioner, and he understood taxes pretty well. And he had formed an agricultural association of farmers. And he began to note that Georgia Pacific, which had just then started its operations in this state, were cutting timber very rapidly in Coos Bay, where they bought the timber that they had bought from Coos Bay Lumber Company. And yet they were receiving this 40% discount. So he just put two and two together and said, gee, I'm helping pay their taxes. So his association began to put pressure on the assessor down there, Coos Bay, whose name was Call, C-A-U-G-H-E-L-L, I think. And then the pressure got to State Tax Commission. And to make the story a little shorter, this commission began to move then to placing the timber on the rolls at a higher and higher value, because one of the commissioners, Sam Stewart, was an attorney, and he felt that constitutionally this 40% discounting process would not be valid. So the Tax Commission began to move in the direction of pushing these values up until, and then they indicated that eventually they'd go to full market value, which meant that there had to be, if we were to get any relief from that, we'd have to go to the legislature. Whereas a company filed a suit when the Tax Commission began to do this, against that kind of